The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of Astronomy Cast is brought to you by Swinburne Astronomy Online, the world's longest-running online astronomy degree program. Visit astronomy.swin.edu.au for more information.
Astronomy Cast, episode 208 from Monday, November 22nd, 2010. The Spitzer Space Telescope. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, our weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Ebersville. Hi, Pamela. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Fraser. How are you doing?
Great. So just another plug, because we're in a, you know, in this plugging mood. To clear out Pamela's spare bedroom, you can buy cool Astronomy Cast gear at astrogear.org. So check that out and support the show and impress your friends with your witty t-shirt.
And if you're in TAM Australia this week, which I know is very, very few of you because it's a very, very small event, we will have, and by we I mean I will have some Astronomy Cast shirts there that the Skeptics booth has been friendly enough to allow me to sell there.
Yeah, you're gonna be like last minute, right? You're gonna be doing part of the amazing meeting. You're gonna be doing a talk there?
Yeah, I have to admit I don't know what day I'm talking on yet. I'm gonna be giving a talk on basically using curiosity in the scientific method to inspire curiosity and awe.
Cool. And I mean, this was like just last minute. I know that you,
totally
a month ago,
last
minute. Yeah, you didn't even know you were going to be there. So Sorry we didn't announce it better. We really had no idea this was going to happen.
There's nothing like a last minute trip 180 degrees around the planet.
Gee, whatever. Travel, you know, you're used to it. I just assume you're in a constant state of travel unless told otherwise. So, you know. Okay, well, then let's get on with the show. So last week we talked about Lyman Spitzer, and this week we'll take a look at the orbiting observatory that bears his name, the Spitzer Space Telescope. Designed to see into the infrared spectrum, Spitzer has returned images of objects that were previously hidden to astronomers by thick shrouds of gas and dust. Now, I think we you know, you had kind of given a sneak peek of this week with last week and about Spitzer, formerly known as
Certif,
which doesn't roll off the tongue as nicely.
But it's kind of cool.
What was Certif? What did that stand for?
It was the Space Infrared Telescope Facility. And I think Certif sounded kind of cool. It sounds like a surf shop, but that's okay. You can laugh at me here. Insert laughter.
No. It's genuine. Right. So you know, Space Infrared Telescope Facility. So this was from the ground up, an infrared observatory, but designed to be a space observatory. But I know that infrared is one of those wavelengths that do get through the atmosphere. So you don't necessarily need to go to space to see infrared.
Well, actually you do. There's only very narrow bands of the infrared that gets down to the surface of the Earth. So if you're lucky enough to be able to see what you want to see in these very narrow bands and at very high altitudes on very dry days and enough of these very difficult to align characteristics all come into reality at the same time, then yes, you can get ground-based images. But the majority of the infrared wavelengths are best observed from outer space. And there's also the problem that, well, infrared's thermal energy. And so from the surface of the planet, we're essentially looking through a brightly glowing atmosphere. So even in the dead of night, on the coldest of nights on our planet Earth, that sky is giving off its own infrared radiation. And it's kind of like trying to observe the stars in visible light at noon. Sure, you could try, but you're only going to be able to see the very brightest stars. And you're never going to see them well because the sunlight's drowning you out. In the infrared, it's just the atmosphere's thermal heat is drowning you out.
Right, right. And so for the perfect environment, you really need a not only a cold telescope, but a cooled telescope that's,
exactly.
that's even, you know, colder than the background of space. And that's when you can see those really subtle differences. Okay, so then where did the concept of an infrared telescope space observatory come from?
Well, in the 70s and 80s, NASA started developing an idea to have a set of great observatories. And this began to become reality in the 90s. And the plan was to have the Hubble Space Telescope, an X-ray observatory, a gamma ray observatory, an infrared facility. And today, those four great plans have become the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, Chandra, which observes in the X-ray, Hubble, which is still going strong, and Spitzer, which is now on the warm part of its mission, because it does require a essentially expendable fuel in the form of helium. And this one mission has gone through just an amazing redesign from its conception to its launch. When they were designing these four missions, the plan was we were going to do everything all the time with the U.S. Space Shuttle. It was going to be the wonderful device that went to space on a weekly basis, able to stay up there 30 days at a time, able to carry things up, carry them down. It was going to be a reliable pickup truck that could haul anything. And it
wasn't. A shuttle to space.
Yes.
Yeah. As opposed to a very complicated and delicate, powerful vehicle that it turned out to be.
Right. It's kind of like borrowing grandpa's farm truck. You're pretty sure it's going to get you to the mall and back, but you're never completely convinced.
Right. Right. And so Spitzer, you know, Hubble was carried on the shuttle. And Spitzer was designed to be carried on the shuttle, but that's not how it turned out.
Well, and they actually had to redesign it. So the original plan for this mission is in retrospect, absolutely ludicrous. The idea was they were going to carry it up into space inside the space shuttle, use it attached to the space shuttle, bring it back on the space shuttle, and just towed it to and fro so that they could refurbish the liquid helium needed to cool it off on a regular basis. The problem with these missions is even when you put them in space, they're still getting heated up by the planet Earth. So if you have an infrared facility that's orbiting the planet, it's going to blow straight through all of its coolant, trying to protect the spacecraft not just from the heat of the sun, but the re-radiated heat of the Earth. And it was a great idea up until, unfortunately, we had the Challenger explosion. And Challenger forced a lot of things to change. And one of the things that happened was not only did they say, okay, no more carrying stuff back down from space, but they also said, well, some of the chemicals you're planning to launch with CERDF, you can't launch anymore. So they had to take this wonderfully, strangely planned yo-yo of an infrared telescope and redesign it to launch on a smaller Delta rocket. And the smaller Delta rocket and the not bringing it back down to the planet on a regular basis meant that the coolant couldn't get regularly recharged. And not only that, but due to weight considerations, they couldn't carry as much coolant. And this set of complications led to an actually really revolutionary design, some concepts of which are getting stolen for the James Webb Space Telescope.
Can you give me some examples?
Well, the biggest example is the sunshade that it has. If you look at images of the Spitzer telescope, there's the standard telescope tube in the center. But then the spacecraft components are on basically supports with a gap between the electronic parts of the spacecraft and the tube and optical assembly of the space telescope. And then beside all of this is this weird, why is that there, basically fin of material or section of a tube of material. And that random extra bit that sticks off the side, that's providing the spacecraft with shade, protecting it from getting heated up by the sun's light.
So it's like it's carrying around its own umbrella to protect the spacecraft from just even a slight amount of heating from the sun. And so that allows its coolant to last longer.
A pre-installed parasol, you might say.
Yeah. And if you see the models, I mean, you're exactly right. You see the model of the James Webb, and they've taken that to the next level. There's this huge, you know, shade, sunshade that's being used to keep the spacecraft cool.
And the other neat thing that they're doing with Spitzer that is different from what they're doing with James Webb is with both spacecraft, you want to protect them from Earth shine to allow their coolant to last absolutely as long as possible. Well, with James Webb, they're sticking it out in basically the shadow of the moon. Well, with Spitzer, what they're doing instead is instead of having it orbit the planet Earth, they're having it orbit the sun. And so when it got launched at an escape velocity that put it in a trailing orbit where every year it lags a little bit further and further behind the Earth. And right now, if you look at maps showing from a top-down perspective on our solar system where Spitzer and the planet Earth happen to be located, if the solar system were a clock, they're about an hour and a half to 2 hours apart on that clock.
That's crazy that you would want to keep the telescope away from the Earth so that it wouldn't be heated up by the reflected sunlight bouncing off the Earth.
Hey,
like that's they're serious about keeping this spacecraft cold.
This mission was all about insane things to get good IR data. So if you're not going to treat it like a yo-yo on the space shuttle, well, let's stick it in a screwy but completely successful orbit.
Yeah, yeah. And this is great. I mean, this is this... You know, with Hubble, they wanted to keep it close and they wanted to be able to upgrade it. And that's one whole philosophy. And it's worked quite well. I mean, they've gone back up to Hubble. They've repaired it. In some cases, they've repaired it in ways that no one had ever expected they were going to have to repair it. But you take this other philosophy and say, well, you know, let's put it in the most useful place it can be to get the best science. But let's build it right the first time and not even, let's make do with what we've built. And not necessarily think of ways that we can upgrade it later. And, you know, both philosophies make a lot of sense. Spitzer is that second philosophy, which is it's going to become unreachable. And so it had to be done right the first time.
And part of that difference that you're seeing is a difference in when they were built. Hubble was the first of the great observatories to be assembled, and Spitzer was the last. And Hubble was already complete when the Challenger had its accident. And because of that, it basically was done. They weren't going to retrofit it in any way in order to rescue it from the changes that were forced upon it by all of the new regulations. It was designed to come back down to Earth. It didn't get to do that, but instead we redesigned how we handled it. With Spitzer, it wasn't assembled yet, so they had the chance to go through and rethink their design and re-engineer what was getting done to meet the mission's goals in a new and very creative way.
So it was launched, as you said, launched in 2003, August 25th, 2003, on a Delta II rocket into this, I guess, solar orbit trailing the Earth. And then what happened?
Then it started changing our perspective on the universe. It's really made a just series of amazing discoveries over the course of its life. For the first several years, in fact, up until May of 2009, it was cooled with liquid helium down to a temperature of about 4 degrees Kelvin. And this allowed it to not just peer into the interstellar medium, but peer through the interstellar medium to see what was on the other side of all the clouds of gas, all the clouds of dust that blocked our view of the center of the galaxy. It allowed us to see in detail the star formation going on in neighboring galaxies and to basically see fragments of stellar remnants, details of planetary nebula that we never quite imagined.
I mean, this is really significant. I mean, you can imagine, as an analogy, I mean, you look around your town and there are patches of fog that you could just never see into. And you had no idea. You had an idea that it's probably buildings in there, but, you know, you have no idea what's in them. And then for the first time, this observatory could actually pierce through the stuff and reveal. And if you see so many of the images that you're going to see on, for example, Universe Today and others are these Spitzer images. I mean, it's become such a valuable instrument for peering through this stuff. And we're seeing pictures that nobody had any way of seeing before Spitzer.
And some of the most fascinating ones are, for instance, if you look at images of the Bach globules and visible light, these are giant clouds of nothing. It's the never-ending story eating the galaxy. But then you look at these nothings with Spitzer, and suddenly you're seeing starlight from the other side.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the process that's going on here? Why are we not able to see this stuff, and then we're able to see it with Spitzer?
Well, what happens is, as light in all the different colors of the electromagnetic spectrum passes through different media, gas, dust, various materials, it gets absorbed, and the colors of the light that get absorbed depend on two different things. One, the shorter wavelengths in the visible light are the first to go. This is, in many cases, just simple Raleigh scattering. The blue light passing through gets absorbed and then re-emitted in all sorts of random directions, and this diminishes the amount of blue light that goes straight through the cloud. This is where certain nebulae, if you view them face on with a bright star behind the nebula and you look through the nebula at that bright star, you see it as red. Whereas if you see the light reflected off to the side where the star is to the left and the cloud is straight in front of you, then the nebula will appear blue because you're not seeing the direct light from the star. You're only seeing that reflected blue light from the star. So as more and more of the blue, the yellows, as all these visible wavelengths get scattered in random directions, that only leaves the infrared to make it all the way through the gas and cloud and dust. So that's where we have to go to see through the dust, is we have to look in the wavelengths that can traverse that distance of material.
And with Hubble, Spitzer has turned up, you know, discoveries that I don't think the astronomers ever suspected that they were going to be finding. I mean, it's been used for extrasolar planets. It's been used for looking the newly forming stars. It's been looking at the core of galaxies. It's looking right out to the very limits of the universe. So what are some of the big highlights that have come out of Spitzer?
Well, I think my very favorite result to come out of it was the astronomers, and I'm going to mispronounce one of them, the astronomers Alexander Kozlinski and John Mather. They went back and looked at one of the original test images that was taken with Spitzer, one of the original pretty pictures they took to prove that the telescope worked. And when they looked at it, they realized that once they accounted for all the known sources of light, all the things that we knew were there from visible images, there's still numerous blobs left behind. And they realized that this background light, this glow, was probably from stars that formed as early as 100 million years after the Big Bang. So quite by accident, we captured the first starlight while making a pretty picture.
And this is one of those situations where the telescope gives you this tantalizing glimpse at what might be these first stars. And this is where James Webb should come along and really give us the real view. But still, I mean, the earliest stars is amazing. Spitzer was the first to directly observe an extrasolar planet.
And then that's part of its continued WARM mission. Unfortunately, about a year, well, not even that, more than a year ago now, back in May of 2009, Spitzer ran out of helium. But some of its instruments were designed to keep working even once the telescope warmed up to its current temperature of tens of degrees Kelvin.
Yeah, this is all part of the plan.
And so they still have a working telescope. It's still within communications of the Earth. At some point, it's going to pass behind the sun, and we're going to lose our ability to talk to it for a while. But we can still talk to it. It's still functioning just fine. And as we find planets that transit in front of their parent star, Spitzer's able to catch the reflected sunlight. And we're also discovering weird stuff with it. There have been planets found that they don't pass directly in front of their host star. They pass above and below it as they go round and round on a tilted orbit. And we've noticed that there's hot spots in some of these planets. And the hot spots aren't at the noon position in the atmosphere. They're not directly on line between the center of the planet and the star. And trying to understand how you get this weirdly located hotspot is leading atmospheric planetary scientists to have to work all sorts of cool stuff with their models.
But I mean, that is mind-bending.
Yeah.
You know, that Spitzer is seeing the atmospheres of planets orbiting other stars with such a resolution that they can see where the hot spots in the atmosphere is, and it doesn't match up with their expectations. So it's another puzzle. But, you know, atmosphere, hot spots, and the atmospheres of other planets.
Yeah, and here it starts to become just a matter of combining excellent data with just really brilliant thinking. We can only see 50% of a planet at a time. That's one of the problems with only being able to see things that appear in the flat of the sky. And by timing when we see a planet brightening, we can figure out where east to west as it rotates a bright spot appears. So we don't know exactly where the hot spot is, but thanks to timing, we can figure out where along a band on the planet these hot spots are located. And it's just amazing science that they're still pulling out of this. And they're studying active galactic nuclei. They're finding buckyballs, carbon molecules shaped like soccer balls in obscured supernovae. And these are just all fabulous things that we can't get at from the surface of the Earth.
The youngest star ever seen was found a couple of years ago. And I think one of my absolute favorite images, and I wasn't there for this, but I think you were there, mm-hmm. At the American Astronomical Society, where they'd spent hundreds of hours observing the Milky Way, milking the central sort of the core of the Milky Way and sort of out into the arms. And they blew up these huge posters of these images and had them available in at the meeting.
Yeah, this was one of those times where in order to see what they had done at roughly full resolution, I don't think it was even at full resolution, they had to cover a convention center wall down mm-hmm. much of the length of the wall with this printout of the survey. And it was an infrared image of across the center of our own Milky Way. And that was just fabulous.
And it completely changed our understanding even of the structure of the center of the Milky Way. So, I mean, once again, once you can see past this fog, you've just got all this additional information that you can get. Just astonishing. And I mean, it's been going for 7 years. So, I mean, we could spend 2-3 shows talking about all of the wonderful science that's come back from Spitzer. But what would you say is sort of the big takeaway? What is the sort of core science that is kind of leading astronomical thinking these days? Because I know a lot of this has kind of gone into the planning for the James Webb, right?
I have to say, this is one of those times where NASA built an extremely versatile instrument that hasn't just taken one area of science and brought it leaps and bounds further along, but instead it's built an instrument that has allowed science ranging from studies of asteroids in our own solar system to studies of the chemistry of clouds in our Milky Way to studies of the accretion disks around black holes in other galaxies to studies of the very first stars turning on in the first 100 million years of the universe. All across all the different times of our universe and scales at which we study things, Spitzer has been able to have an impact. And that really speaks to the power of building these great observatories.
And so where we stand right now, as you said, we're a couple of years after the helium ran out. So what science can it no longer gather?
it can't go into the longest wavelengths that it used to be able to study. So it's not going to be able to see the same sorts of things embedded in the interstellar media. It's not going to be able to do the same studies of newly forming stars. And perhaps saddest of all, it no longer is able to use its fabulous spectrographs. So our ability to study the chemistry of many of these different things is completely gone until we get a new telescope. But it still has its imaging abilities in the shortest of its wavelengths. So we're still doing the extrasolar planets. We're still doing the asteroid studies, still looking at AGNs. So can't measure the chemistry anymore, can't peer through the same levels of dust and gas, but there's still lots of fabulous stuff that it can do.
And then what is the overlap between the capabilities of Spitzer and the James Webb? Because, I mean, the James Webb, I mean, a lot of people say it's the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, but I think it's a much more appropriate to say it's a successor to Spitzer.
I completely agree with that. Yeah, Hubble does infrared, but it's not what it was designed for as its fundamental mission. Spitzer is definitely the intellectual parent to James Webb. And the way I think of it is the difference between a really cruddy, kind of hard to focus old television stolen from grandpa and a brand new high definition plasma screen, if that's the superior technology. I have to admit, right. I'm not up on my TVs.
But the kinds of instruments are going to be very similar. It's just that you're going to have a much more sensitive telescope to see further and deeper. And
it's the double whammy of both being able to see much fainter objects because it's a much larger light gathering area and it's a much more sensitive set of instruments. But not only are you going to be able to see the much, much fainter objects, which gives you a greater contrast, but you're going to be able to see them at a much, much higher resolution. So it's this combination of more pixels and more sensitive pixels that are going to essentially allow us to see the beginnings of everything.
Yeah. And so at some point we'll cover James Webb in more detail. We keep waiting because, you know, we're waiting for it to launch, right? But then we're like, oh, should we talk about it before it launches and really go into it or wait until there's some science results? So
at some point we're going to give in because Webb just keeps getting pushed further into the future. But what's interesting is, so we've now covered many of the named observatories, Kepler, Hubble, Spitzer, Chandra. All of these missions were named after they had successfully sent images back down to Earth, although Hubble's images were a bit out of focus. Spitzer was, in fact, named by public opinion. It was one where they allowed the public to have a say in what it should be named. James Webb wasn't named after a scientist so much, and it was named pretty much as soon as it was funded. And so this is a major break from tradition, and there's this back of the heart, oh no, is that like wishing an actor good luck instead of break a leg? Hopefully we haven't cursed it with Congress or anything like that.
Great. All right. Well, I think that's great. And if you've got a little time, go to Google and type in Spitzer telescope, click on images, and just look at some of the beautiful images. Because like Hubble, the pictures from Spitzer are beautiful and they're meaningful for science and they're just gorgeous to look at. And they would be, you know, you'd be happy to have them on your wall or as your screensaver. So,
and if you have an account in Second Life, they've done this amazing fully walkthrough exhibit of the large survey that Spitzer did. This is the GLIMPSE and Mistgal survey, Galactic Legacy Infrared Midplane Survey Extraordinaire, the one that we were talking about from the conference wall. You can actually walk through that in the virtual reality of Second Life at the Astronomy 2009 Island, and that was put together by Adrien Gauthier.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Pamela, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Talk to you later, Fraser.
This has been Astronomy Cast, a weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos. Show notes and transcripts for every episode are available on our website. Check it out at astronomycast.com. You can send us any comments, questions, or feedback to info@astronomycast.com. We read every email. The show is a nonprofit educational resource provided by Fraser Cain and Dr. Pamela Gay. We're supported through the kind donations of listeners like you. If you enjoy Astronomy Cast, why not give us a donation? It helps us pay for bandwidth, transcripts, and show notes. Just click the donate link on the website. All donations are tax deductible for U.S. taxpayers. You can support the show for free, too. Write a review or recommend it to your friends. Every little bit helps. Click support the show on our website to see some suggestions. To subscribe to the show, point your podcatching software at astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or subscribe directly from iTunes. Music is provided by Travis Searle. The show was edited by Preston Gibson. Astronomy Cast is produced at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville with generous support from Universe Today.